I can guarantee you that shows very clearly on the video.
Senator David Wilson says evidence that the public hasn't seen shows he didn't sexually harass a legislative staffer. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the danger of an avalanche for even the most experienced skiers.
It just takes that one day with that one wrong decision in the wrong spot, and you have a really bad outcome.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The U.S. Bureau of Land Management, the lead federal agency, is hosting a series of public scoping meetings on the proposed Ambler Road. The meetings are now through Tuesday, December 12th, in several communities near the Ambler Mining District. The BLM is developing an environmental impact statement and seeking public input. Learn more at blm.gov/AmblerRoadEIS. This message is sponsored by BLM.
The U.S. Senate today confirmed Alaskan Joe Balash as Assistant Secretary of Interior for Land and Minerals Management. Balash was Alaska's Commissioner of Natural Resources, then became Chief of Staff for Senator Dan Sullivan. Both of Alaska's senators say he's well qualified for the job to head the Bureau of Land Management, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, and other offices. But there was dissent. Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell pointed out that Balash pressed Alaska's failed claim to 20,000 acres on the edge of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Cantwell of Washington State argued if Balash has the interior job, he'd be able to act as judge on his old case. And she says it's unlikely he would be required to recuse himself.
A claim that was turned down, he could reverse that.
Sullivan says Balash's experience is an asset.
The idea of making yourself be recused because you have expertise in policy from your state job when you go into a federal job to me seems, well, outrageous.
In the end, Balash won a bipartisan vote, 61 to 38. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky says he's looking forward to Balash playing a critical role in coal country. Three Congress members opposed to drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge are challenging the revenue projections, and they have fresh evidence on their side. The Democratic members wrote a letter asking the Congressional Budget Office to reevaluate the estimate that lease sales in the refuge could raise $2.2 billion over 10 years, split evenly between the federal treasury and the state of Alaska. The letter from top Democrats on the House Resources Committee points to the annual lease sale held this week for the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska to the west of Prudhoe Bay. More than 10 million acres were offered, but bids totaled just over $1 million. The letter says at that rate, the coastal plain of the refuge would raise only $180,000. The NPRA lease was lackluster compared to last year's. Only seven tracts drew bids yesterday. One longtime observer of Alaska's petroleum industry says companies may have concluded most of the promising tracts in the reserve are either already leased or currently off limits. The Arctic Refuge sits to the east of Prudhoe Bay. A budget bill pending in Congress could open the refuge to its first lease sale. The letter writers are Raul Grijalva of Arizona and Californians Jared Huffman and Alan Lowenthal. They did not mention this week's state lease sale on the North Slope. It raised $21 million in high bids. Wasilla Republican Senator David Wilson said today the video of a June incident shows he did not sexually harass a female legislative staff member.
My phone is off. It never leaves the waist side of my body. It goes from my hand, I'm holding papers, down, comes back up. I never bend down. It does not go to the door. It does not go between anyone's legs. I can guarantee you that shows very clearly on the video. I am a couple of great distance away from anybody during that conversation that occurred.
But two news reporters have said Wilson held his cell phone between the legs of the staffer. Wilson was speaking at a press conference he put together and called for an on-air apology from KTVA reporter Liz Raines' coverage of the incident. And he called on House Speaker Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham Democrat, and House Rules Chairwoman Gabrielle Ledoux, an Anchorage Republican, to step down from their leadership positions.
Allegations are being reproduced as facts, and lives are being put in jeopardy without a hearing, due process, or evidence. I hope we can give people the benefit of the doubt before we rush to judgment. I have continuously denied these appalling allegations that are being peddled about me. It did not happen.
Wilson claims a staff member of the Legislative Affairs Agency told Edgman what was on the video. Wilson says Edgman allowed harassment allegations to continue without asking for an investigation. Edgman said in a written statement, quote, "Senator Wilson crossed the line of appropriate behavior by using a press conference to chastise individuals who came forward as witnesses to an alleged incident of harassment," end quote. Edgman said he believes it violates the legislature's harassment policy and warrants a serious investigation by the Senate. Edgman said he couldn't both pursue the matter and respect the staff members' wishes to keep it private and not politicized. Wilson says the agency has concluded an investigation. He called for the video as well as the report on the investigation to be publicly released in the next week. Legislative rules say security video may not be released to the public. Senate President Pete Kelly has asked the Senate Rules Committee to hold a hearing to consider releasing the report. Wilson spoke at the Anchorage Legislative Information Office today. An hour and a half later, the Legislative Council Subcommittee on Sexual and Other Workplace Harassment Policy met. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says people who make harassment complaints should be updated on how their complaints are being handled.
People who make complaints don't know whether their superiors have actually acted on their behalf.
Other subcommittee members say the policy should spell out potential consequences for both lawmakers and legislative employees for harassment. The subcommittee is expected to recommend changes to the policy before the next legislative session. The recent avalanche death of a longtime Anchorage ski coach with decades of experience in Alaska's mountains shocked those who knew him. But as much as Randy Burkt knew about avalanche danger, his death represents a phenomenon not unfamiliar in backcountry skiing. As Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reports, even snow safety experts get caught in avalanches.
Ski racing was a big part of the soundtrack to Randy Burkt's life. He spent years coaching up-and-coming skiers, including the dominant service high school teams in the mid to late 90s, and even some athletes who went on to the Olympics. The recently retired 60-year-old was considered a pillar of the ski community. Service's recent snowball ski race finals were dedicated to him.
Let's aim our loudest cheers to the finalists who are going to show us all how Randy would want it done.
It isn't a surprise Burkt's contributions to skiing are part of how he's being memorialized. More unexpected is that he died skiing, buried under 4 feet of snow at Hatcher Pass the day before Thanksgiving.
It's like finding out the best driver you knew just got in a bad car wreck.
That's Gary Snyder, a high school science teacher and fellow ski coach who spent time in the backcountry with Burkt.
You know, here's a guy who had a ton of experience. He thought things through a lot. He paid attention to details, and clearly, he knew a lot about avalanches, and then to have him die in an avalanche is really shocking.
Snyder's not alone in struggling to understand what happened. Burkt was with two other skiers on Marmot Mountain and was the first to descend. The most recent forecast noted a weak layer in the snowpack. Burkt triggered an avalanche reportedly 150 feet wide by 800 feet long. His group carried all the recommended avalanche rescue gear, beacons, probes, and shovels. Burkt's partners dug him out, but their attempt to resuscitate him was unsuccessful. Hatcher Pass Avalanche Center Director Jed Workman says a major factor in the accident is that instead of fanning out, the snow funneled into what's known as a terrain trap.
This was a fairly thin avalanche, but getting buried in a ravine, it increased the depth.
Avalanche hazard was rated considerable, but considerable is in the middle of a scale that has 5 degrees of risk, and it doesn't mean the entire forecast area is unsafe. Workman says the forecast is just one part of the puzzle.
There's just no guarantee that any one of us is going to put all the pieces together every single time. Accidents are going to happen. And it's not a reflection necessarily of our skill.
Still, friends and family say Randy Burke was about the last person you would expect to be buried in an avalanche. Burke was a professional patroller at Utah's Alta ski area for 11 winters. He made hundreds of human-powered alpine ascents and descents. Burke's backcountry buddies say he was among the most careful skiers they've ever known. But Workman and Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center Director Wendy Wagner say the more time someone spends in avalanche terrain, the more they are exposed to the risk of getting caught in one.
There's no way you're going to be able to reduce a risk to zero to be able to know for sure slope's not going to avalanche.
Wagner says avid skiers will face so many variables that are often unseen and completely out of their control that the odds of an accident increase over time.
It just takes that one day with that one wrong decision in the wrong spot, and you have a really bad outcome.
Like everyone else interviewed for this story, Wagner doesn't blame Burke for his death. But the impulse in others to assign blame might have deeper origins. Paul Wunneke is a longtime friend and ski buddy of Burke's, and also a trained avalanche professional. He's on the Alaska Avalanche School Board of Directors. Though he admits he's no psychoanalyst, Wunneke has a theory about why people are quick to judge victims of accidents like the one that befell his friend.
If you can sit in your armchair and say, well, you know, I would do this and I would do that and I wouldn't have done this and I wouldn't have done that, then you feel a little bit better about all the times that you had near misses that you don't even know about.
Wunneke says there's a lack of negative feedback for bad decisions made in the backcountry because more often than not, nothing goes wrong.
If it didn't avalanche and we're home by our sweeties by the fire at the end of the day, then we must have made good decisions. And that isn't necessarily what happened. In reality, it might just be that we were very lucky.
Wunneke says Burke would have wanted his death to cause others to learn more about traveling in the mountains, to think critically about the risks while they're there, and to communicate with their partners. And he says Burke would have also wanted one other thing.
Absolutely. Without a doubt, I know Randy would say, go skiing. That's what Randy would want us to do.
For cross-country skiers hoping to honor Burke, a memorial ski event is planned for Sunday, December 10th on the trails behind Service High. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
Meanwhile, the most recent forecasts indicate high avalanche danger at both Hatcher and Turnagain Passes. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a plan to make new Nutak houses out of old military barracks.
Back home, the living quarters are so small. Some of the houses have like 9 people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Going without health insurance could be financially devastating. Healthcare bills are the leading cause of personal bankruptcy. Open enrollment for 2018 plans is November 1st through December 15th. A household of four with an annual income of less than $123,000 may qualify for federal tax credits to help cover premium costs. Get signed up for health insurance at healthcare.gov today. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
The father of a 5-year-old Anchorage boy who fatally shot himself has been arrested on a federal weapons count. Anthony Johnson is charged with being a felon in possession of a gun. Johnson was convicted of drug possession with intent to distribute in May of 2012. Anchorage police early Tuesday took a call on the shooting at the home. Police determined Christian Johnson found the gun in a bedroom nightstand drawer and shot himself in the head. Johnson told investigators he bought the pistol for his fiancée and taught her how to use it. He said a friend asked him to hold several rifles. A ballot initiative aimed at protecting Alaska's salmon habitat is kicking up a controversy. Environmental groups say it's a needed step to protect Alaska's most iconic and lucrative fish. But the state, many industry groups, and several Alaska Native corporations are speaking out against it. If Alaskans are confused about what the ballot initiative would actually do, that's understandable. That's because both sides can't seem to agree on how it would affect future development in Alaska. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk dug into the details.
At a Stand for Salmon event held in Anchorage this fall, supporter Arlo Davis collected his first signature.
Wonder if you'd like to be my first signature on my booklet.
I'd be very happy to.
Right on.
All right, thank you.
As he signed on, Kevin Illingworth said, like a lot of Alaskans, he thinks protecting salmon should be a priority.
I know the importance of salmon to our entire state, not just any one group or individuals, but to all of us.
That was just one of 32,127 signatures Stand for Salmon's organizers need to pin down before mid-January to get it on the ballot. And that's not the only hurdle. The state thinks the initiative is unconstitutional and is challenging it in court. Here are some basics. The initiative assumes all the state's water bodies are habitat for salmon and other similar fish species, unless proven otherwise. If a project will significantly impact salmon habitat, it's put through a much tougher vetting process. And importantly, the initiative gives the state more power to stop projects altogether. Industry groups hate this initiative. This is Deantha Crockett with the Alaska Miners Association speaking about Stand for Salmon at a recent conference.
We don't believe this initiative is standing for salmon at all. We think it's shutting down the state economy, communities, and our way of life.
Other industries and Native corporations banding against the initiative use similar language. They say it will set, quote, near impossible new standards, unquote, for development. Take a big proposed mining project like the Pebble Mine or the Donlin Mine. Those mines are in areas with salmon habitat, which isn't unusual in Alaska.
Probably most large mines are going to somehow impact fish habitat, and that's unavoidable.
Richard Milius is former director of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources Division of Mining, Land, and Water, and he's against the initiative. In some cases, Milius says, a mine's impact is permanent. According to legal documents filed by the state, the Donlin Mine will eliminate two fish streams forever.
When you're creating a permanent facility that's always going to be there, you can't mitigate that specific stream or restore that specific stream because it's not there anymore.
But Milia says companies can't just walk away and do nothing about it. Today, the state makes them compensate by restoring salmon habitat somewhere else, sometimes in a different water body. The Stand for Salmon initiative would tighten the rules. All restoration, mitigation, or preservation has to be in the same water body that's damaged. If that's not possible, then the project can't go forward. Opponents say that's one reason why Stand for Salmon is designed to block big projects like Donlin, but also smaller ones like airstrips and roads. Stand for Salmon's backers say this is an overreaction. Emily Anderson of the Wild Salmon Center helped write the initiative.
If you actually do take a hard look at this and keep an open mind, you'll see that this shift is not going to be dramatic. It's not going to dramatically impact the way you can and do business.
Anderson argues that in many cases, project builders can avoid permanently damaging salmon streams by putting a mine in a slightly different spot or by using different technology. But Anderson also acknowledges that under the initiative, some projects won't make the cut.
There's a standard in here, a standard of care that says if you're going to substantially damage the Alaska's fisheries, Fish and Game can say no to your permit.
Anderson says this is a paradigm shift for Alaska, but she says it's an important one.
There has to be some sort of upper limit or upper threshold and the ability built into the system for the state to say, you know, this isn't going to work with us.
But there's another significant wrinkle to this controversy, a legal wrinkle. Stand for Salmon's lawyers and the state's lawyers fundamentally disagree on whether the initiative goes against the state's constitution. The question is, does it mean that one state resource, salmon, would take priority over minerals, oil, hydropower, and all Alaska's other resources? The Alaska Supreme Court will have the final word on that this spring. If the initiative wins in court and gets enough signatures, next year it will be on the ballot. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
We've been reporting on the community of Newtok and its effort to relocate as erosion destroys the existing village. One of the main challenges has been the cost of housing. But now the village thinks it might have part of a solution, one that comes from an unexpected source. Rachel Waldholz from Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
We're driving onto J-Bear, Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. And the solution to Newtok's housing dilemma? It might be found here.
So these are the units right here.
We're
Oh, these are them.
These are them.
Jay Farmwald is with the Denali Commission, the federal agency most involved in trying to relocate Nutak. He's pointing to several long rows of modular dorms, single-story units attached end-to-end. They were used for more than a decade as temporary barracks for soldiers. Now they're empty, and the military has to get rid of them. So they might go to Nutak. Farmwald says he was skeptical at first, but the plan has some major upsides, like cost.
The big part of the equation that is enticing is the barracks are free. So they're access to the military, they're in good condition. They were originally built modular in Seattle and moved up.
So they could be disassembled, barged out to Western Alaska, and reassembled at Nutak's new site. If that sounds kind of nuts, well, it might be. But the problem Nutak's facing is also kind of nuts. The village's current site is rapidly eroding away. But there isn't enough money to move everyone to Muktarvik, their new site upriver. Government agencies that fund infrastructure, like the power plant or the airport, won't commit money until there are enough people at the new site. That means housing. But agencies that fund housing won't commit money without the promise of infrastructure. It's a chicken and the egg situation, and Farmwald says it's been an obstacle for years. He says this plan would get a critical mass of houses to the new site all at once.
And that might be just enough to get the snowball really rolling down the hill.
The barracks are pretty plain. Beige siding, red metal doors. Daryl Parks from the base walks us inside.
So what these were is they were a three-man barrack.
The barracks have three bedrooms, a small kitchenette, and a bathroom. They're pretty Spartan. But Jimmy Charles Jr., who heads the Nutak Native Corporation, says that's not a problem.
It's a lot better than what they have at the villages.
Charles says the housing in Nutak is so dilapidated and overcrowded that these decade-old temporary barracks would be a major improvement.
Back home, the living quarters are so small. Some of the houses have nine people.
The plan is to put two of these units together to create single-family homes. Charles's wife, Catherine, who sits on the Nutak Village Council, says she's already imagining moving in. The couple's current home has two bedrooms and eight people. She's lost her voice, so she's a little hoarse.
I can't wait to move in here with my own bedroom.
A feasibility study determined that the cost of remodeling the units, disassembling them, barging them to Nutak, and reassembling them is still less than building similar-sized homes new, testament to the high cost of construction in rural Alaska. But it will still take an estimated $4.5 million to get one barge full, or about 13 homes, to the new site. The Denali Commission has come up with most of that funding. The village is still working out the last million. If all goes according to plan, there could be as many as 20 homes and maybe 100 people living at the new village site by the end of 2019. It's perhaps a quarter of the housing they'll eventually need, but after more than a decade of trying, it would be something of a miracle for Nutak. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholtz in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ExxonMobil Alaska. Their financial investment and partnership with local companies at Point Thompson helps contribute to Alaska's economy and jobs for Alaskans. ExxonMobil, energy lives here. Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
The Coast Guard has suspended a search for two men missing after a boat capsized in Juneau's Gastineau Channel. The agency says 50-year-old James Cole and 48-year-old Sheridan Scott Stringer were not found. Three men, two women and a dog, on Tuesday night were in a skiff that took on water and capsized. A witness near the breakwater at Aurora Harbor called Juneau police about 9 p.m. to report screaming from Aurora Harbor. Two women in the boat swam to a dock, got in another boat, and looked for the men. One man climbed onto the capsized boat and was rescued by the Coast Guard. The dog also survived. The women were treated for exposure. Alaskans, have you been scammed? That's the question federal regulators are trying to answer after a massive settlement with the company Western Union. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, officials don't know how many people may have been affected, but they're looking for victims and hoping to return money residents might have lost to dirty tricks.
In a lawsuit settled last January, the money transfer company Western Union agreed to turn over almost $600 million and admitted it had not done enough to prevent fraud. Now, the federal government wants to return that money to people who were swindled.
If someone sent a money transfer through Western Union and they lost money to a scam, then they're eligible to ask for their money back.
Todd Kossow is a director for the Federal Trade Commission's Midwest region, and he says the period in question stretches from 2004 all the way to 2017. People across the country were targeted for scams, many of them online or over the phone. Victims were told they'd won a foreign sweepstakes but had to send money to cover a fee in order to claim their winnings, or grandparents were contacted and told their grandchildren were in trouble abroad and needed money wired right away. Though Western Union didn't commit any of these frauds, Kossow says the company agreed it had failed to stop scams and prevent money laundering.
Essentially, it didn't do enough to protect people from fraud, and it didn't properly discipline agents that were facilitating the fraud.
Nobody knows how many people fell victim during the 13-year period covered by the settlement. Scams like these tend to target vulnerable populations. In Alaska, there have been only a few official complaints reported, but Assistant Attorney General Cindy Franklin suspects many people haven't come forward out of confusion, embarrassment, or shame over being tricked.
The scams are specifically designed to press on fears of specific groups like the elderly or immigrants, people for whom English is a second language, and that opens up a whole additional shame spiral, and that's what makes it difficult for us to know exactly how many people this kind of thing has happened to.
People who suspect they've been victims of a scam that involved Western Union have until February 12th of 2018 to file a claim and potentially recover some of their money. In Anchorage, I'm Zechariah Hughes.
The Federal Trade Commission wants residents to submit claims online. Links are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, and Rachel Waldholz, Elizabeth Harbaugh, Casey Grove, and Zechariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The University of Alaska's founders knew that to build a great state, we would need a great university. Today, UA offers more than 400 degrees and certificates with campuses from Kotzebue to Ketchikan. They are leaders in Arctic and Alaska research and dedicated to direct hands-on teaching, whether online, in the classroom, or in the field. Greatness awaits you. See how the University of Alaska can help you achieve at alaska.edu/starthere. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.